Hello and welcome to the Scottish Hibs and News podcast with me, Kieran Finlay, and Jimmy Black. When highlighting the positive impact that social housing has across Scotland on this podcast, we are very much preaching to the choir, but sometimes that isn't enough. To dispel myths or remove any stigma regarding the sector, we need to bang the drum to those outside the housing bubble. And to effect any real change, we need to convince our elected leaders that their priorities align with ours, and that social landlords can be the driving force for delivering a fair and just society.
And that's what the SFHA is hoping to do with their new campaign, to put housing at the heart of Scotland and keep it there. Launched earlier this year, the campaign has entered a new stage that will focus on influencing the programme for government, with a range of policy requests to ensure that social landlords are given the required support.
Joining us to explore the campaign and more is the SFHA's Director of External Affairs, Carolyn Lockhead. Hi Carolyn, thanks for coming on. For all the vital work that social landlords carry out every day, they're not always the best at highlighting this. I know from many conversations I've had that there's often a reluctance to come across as overtly self-congratulating, and especially when tenants are seen to be and are struggling. Or perhaps they're just like too busy getting on with the job. Is that part of the thinking behind this campaign?
Yeah, I think what we want to do is shine a light on the amazing work that our members do. So SFHA represents 137 housing associations and cooperatives up and down Scotland. We have 94% of the sector in our membership. So we're really well placed to talk about the good work that the sector does. I think you're right, maybe people are modest, maybe as you say, they're too busy getting on with the job. But one of the reasons you have a membership body is to be able to do those things for you. So Housing at Scotland's Heart is really about showcasing the work that our members do in providing safe, warm, affordable homes, and the importance of that, because the work that housing associations do, I mean, it's so fundamental to people across Scotland. It's fundamental to a lot of the Scottish Government's objectives. And it's something that deserves to be talked about.
The campaign started in June with the launch of results from a survey of 45 of the housing associations that you mentioned, in total, I think, representing at least 84,000 tenants. What did the survey find?
What the survey showed us was that housing associations do a lot more than just provide a house. It showed us that that our members were providing services like welfare advice, energy advice, employability services, links into the community, links to things that none of us want to be necessary, like food pantries and food banks. Just doing so much more. I think over 9 out of 10 members were providing those kinds of services. And I think it just really highlighted the fact that housing associations, of course they are about homes. Homes are fundamental to what they do. But they are about so much more too, and they're a really important part of communities, and increasingly they are called on and they are stepping up to fill the gaps to make sure that people are getting the support that they need and the services that they need.
Carolyn, can you tell us, have you any stories which show the value of the work that housing associations do locally?
Yeah, one of the things that I like to do best in my job is go out and visit our members. I try and get out to visit members as much as I possibly can, and I always learn something. And one that really stuck in my head is when I went down to Berwickshire Housing Association a while back, and they took me on a bit of a tour of the various things that they do. And they showed me a lunch club that they run that moves around different areas within their patch. And it provides a social space, it provides a lunch for people who might otherwise be a bit isolated, and it also uses produce that's grown by a local community growing organisation. And on the same day, they were telling me about their mental health project, and they told me a story about how someone had gone into a person's house to do a bit of maintenance, just to do a bit of a repair. Were clear that the person they were visiting obviously needed a bit of help and knew how to refer into the mental health project. And I just came away that day so struck by the range of services that they were providing and the way it was all integrated. And, you know, a whole range of our members could have told me similar stories about the way in which they do so much more than just provide a home, if you can say just providing a home when a home is so central. But yeah, it's really striking the work that our members do. It's so much more than you might think it is.
Well, getting on to that point about homes, it's all about homes in the end. And last year's budget, you've been saying, saw a real terms reduction to the affordable housing supply programme. and you called for the reduction to be reversed at a minimum. But was it a reduction? And the Scottish Government don't seem to acknowledge that the budget has actually been reduced. So can you maybe explain why there's a disagreement there? What can you give us both sides of the story?
I think the argument is about the capital budget, which is obviously about the capital spend and the budget that's available for houses. If you look at comparison year on year, there is a reduction in the amount that is available. I think the Scottish Government, and I'm not here to give their side of the argument, but I think the Scottish Government argue that when you take into account all of the other elements of the budget, that has been addressed. And so that we would have a slight difference of opinion. I think where it's quite hard to disagree is that the budget that's available for the Affordable Housing Supply Programme was set quite some time ago. And since then, we've seen very high inflation. We've seen a whole set of economic circumstances that we haven't seen for a long time. And we are seeing real difficulties in achieving the target that the Scottish Government have set and that we support of creating 110,000 affordable homes by 2032. What we hear from our members is that the costs of construction are just becoming so high, and the availability of contractors is a real problem, particularly for members in rural areas. So I think we feel like that budget, we can all fall out about the numbers, and it tends to happen every year at budget time. Everyone's got their own interpretation of the numbers. But what I think is really fundamental is that budget needs to be protected at minimum. And we need to be clear that in order for Scottish Government to achieve all of the things that they've said, particularly poverty reduction, which our new First Minister has quite rightly said is his main priority, social housing is just fundamental to that. And we see, I seem to see a new story every week about the length of waiting lists for social housing. And we're not going to get that down unless we build homes. And in order to build homes, we need to have the right budget. So I think it's a really fundamental issue that we can't lose sight of.
When Hamza Yousaf was campaigning to be elected as leader of the SNP and therefore First Minister, one of his campaign pledges was to assist a social housing acquisitions programme, and he has, to his word, followed that up. But again, you guys, there are concerns about where this funding has come from, isn't there?
Yes, so the funding for acquisitions has come from the Affordable Housing Supply Programme. There's probably a couple of things to say about that. First of all, the idea of acquisitions, and that is buying homes instead of building them, or as well as building them, is one that's been talked about for a while. We did a webinar with our members on it earlier this year, actually, just to learn a bit more about how helpful it was to them, how interested they were in doing more of it. So it's a good thing. I've just been talking about how the cost of construction was so high. So it is sensible to be looking at what can you do as well as building homes. I mean, building homes at pace and in some quantity, I think, is the main way we're going to get to this target that we need to achieve of 110,000 affordable homes. But looking at buying homes, bringing empty homes back into use is a very sensible idea. And you know, why wouldn't you do that? We do think it's regrettable that money has come from the budget that already existed to build new homes. We would have much preferred that was new money. And beyond that, I think what we're hearing from our members is that if the idea of acquiring rather than building homes is really going to help, and Scottish Government are particularly saying they want it to help in tackling homelessness and tackling the high numbers of people who are in temporary accommodation, we need to know much more about how that's going to work. What are the criteria for accessing it? What's the government contribution going to be? So in some areas like Glasgow, we've seen 100% government funding for acquisitions. We're awaiting further guidance from Scottish Government on how the new acquisitions fund will work. So we need to understand that. And also some of our members who operate in areas where there is still a very intense housing market have made the point that actually they need to be able to move really quickly if they're going to get a property, you know, within a matter of days. So how's that going to work? What's the mechanism by which our members can do that? So there's a lot more, I think, to know about that fund. And also there are points about acquisitions, such as, you know, we need to be buying homes in areas where people want to live. That's really important. It's got to be strategic. And we also need to know a little bit more about, once a home becomes a social home, there's a whole range of standards that it needs to meet. So what's the funding going to be for that? How quickly do they need to meet those standards? There's a lot of questions, I think, that we still need to explore on that particular point.
Another issue outside of simply building homes is possibly removing mid-market rent homes from the private centre rent cap. How could that help an RSL?
The mid-market rent is a really popular tender with people who are maybe they're working couples, families, people who are quite unlikely ever to qualify for social housing but are still facing really difficult circumstances in terms of the private rented sector, where we know there's a real shortage of properties and rents can be high, or getting on the housing ladder. And we all know how difficult that is and the issues with house prices and availability. So mid-market rent is a really good tenure where rents are lower than the private market, but usually higher than social rent. And we've seen it being quite popular with tenants who are members in quite a number of different areas of the country. The legislation that came in last year, the Cost of Living Act, introduced rent controls that are currently, they apply only to private sector properties. But the way that legislation is defined, that takes in mid-market rent. It defines mid-market rent as a private sector property, even though it's largely provided by housing associations and cooperatives, so by social housing providers. And the difficulty with that is if you can't set rents at a level that allow you to put the funding that you need to into repairs and maintenance of your property, it becomes really hard to keep building those properties and keep providing them. So one of the things that we're asking Scottish Government for, and just today we've published the calls that we'll be making on them ahead of the Programme for Government, one of the things we're asking them for is to redefine mid-market rent so that it is defined very clearly as a social form of housing and doesn't fall into these private sector rent controls.
Is anyone else delivering mid-market rent other than social landlords?
I mean, you won't be surprised to hear that what I know about is social landlords and housing associations.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not aware of anyone else.
Me neither. I can't put my finger on it, and I could be wrong there. So it seems like an easy step to make anyway.
I was going to ask you a bit more about mid-market rent. There is some resistance. I mean, I've heard anecdotally some resistance from people in the housing association movement to doing mid-market rent. They see it as a way of letting the government off with either nil subsidy or lower subsidy. And they also see it as housing people who can actually afford to house themselves. And the real business, of the housing association movement, some people say, is social renting. So why waste time on mid-market rent? Why let the government off the hook? Have you a response to that?
So I've been in the housing sector now for just over 2 years. I've just gone past my 2 year anniversary at SFHA, having had a career in mental health campaigning and policy. And in those 2 years, what I've learned is that there's a whole range of opinions across the housing sector, and that's quite right. And there should be, and there always will be. Some people do feel that, and that's a totally legitimate view. I think what we hear, I would say probably from the bulk of our members, is that mid-market rent is a helpful way of providing housing to a group of people who, yeah, they're not going to ever qualify for social housing, but still have very genuine issues in accessing safe, warm, affordable housing, which is what the sector is all about. So it's a tenure through which more people can be provided with the kind of home that they need that they simply couldn't afford in any other way. And where it works, it seems to work well for those of our members who provide it. So it seems like not an easy way, because nothing's easy, is it? But a quite a straightforward way to make sure that people who otherwise would be struggling to rent in the private sector or attempting to get onto a housing market ladder that seems ever harder to get onto can access a type of tenancy that is secure, that is theirs, and that is of a good standard.
It also enables people to avoid the stringent requirements, the fairness requirements of allocations policies as laid down by law. In mid-market rent, I don't think you've got the same restrictions on the way that you can allocate houses. Again, that might be seen as unfair to some people.
It's definitely a different, it's a different tenure. It's not the same as social housing, and there's no getting away from that. It's a different approach. But it's an approach that I think it's got an audience, it's meeting a need. And I think nobody is arguing that it should replace social housing. Social housing, I guess, the traditional approach of providing social homes, it remains at the heart of what the sector does. But if mid-market rent can help people who are never going to get near social housing, then it seems to me there's a reasonable argument, and it certainly seems to seem to a number of our members, that there's a reasonable argument for saying, well, can we do both? Can we help both of these groups of people?
And maybe it can help people out of social housing and into a different tenure, which might be advantageous to people who need to socially rent. So, I understand there are arguments on both sides. And that gives me another question to ask you about about buying houses, actually, about this idea of acquiring them. Is it not a danger that you might acquire, or your members might acquire, a lot of dodgy old tenements that have got lots of DIY in them, you know, boilers that people have rigged up themselves, dangerous wiring? You're going to need some money to invest in these properties, aren't you? So how far will 60 million go?
I think that's a great question. And genuinely, I certainly don't know the answer to that at this point. Obviously, our members, I mean, members have been doing acquisitions for a while. It's not a new thing, although there are few who've done it at scale, as I understand it. It is really important that where we're looking at buying homes, that our members have got the choice to do that in the areas that they know they have demand and that they can let those homes. And you're absolutely right that the quality of those properties is sufficient that they can be brought up to standard in a reasonable timescale and within a reasonable budget. We are expecting guidance from the Scottish Government on this new acquisitions fund and how it will work, and we hope it will address some of that. Members often talk to us about acquisitions being a useful way of, for example, where they have maybe a number of properties in a block, they can complete their ownership of that block, and that then makes it much easier to do repairs and to do maintenance. So that can be really helpful. But I think we need to know more about what support will be available, how strategic it's going to be in terms of targeting areas to purchase, and just how it's all going to work. Because you're right, £60 million, it's a lot of money, but depending on the properties that you're buying and how many you're trying to buy, it might not necessarily go that far.
There is another perennial debate being played out, which seems to pit the need to deliver more homes quickly against the need to ensure that the homes are delivered to a high standard, and again, as you've mentioned, to improve the quality of existing stock, all of which brings increased costs. Where do you sit on this? How do you find this balance?
I mean, it's the million-dollar question, isn't it? We know that we need to, particularly, we need to retrofit, we need to decarbonise housing, and we know that we need to do that. Every time you switch on the news, you see another reminder of climate change and of the fact that this is an emergency and we need to do it. But we also have a real housing crisis, and we know that there is a desperate need for these 110,000 affordable homes. And one of the things that our members tell us a lot is there's a lot of priorities and there's not really a lot of sense of which is the top priority and what do we need to do. And partly that's because it's a genuinely really difficult question. I think there are a few ways, you know, we're talking today about what we hope Scottish Government will do in the programme for government. There are a few ways that they could help with that. We know that we're expecting the H2 review, the Energy Efficiency Standard for Social Housing review. The interim report for that is due out later in the year. And what we hear just so frequently from our members is we need that to give them some certainty and some clarity. So in order to be able to do the work that we know we need to do on decarbonising homes, members really need to know what is expected, what is the technology that's going to help, and what support is going to be available. And I think we hear from members really regularly that if they had that kind of certainty and clarity, it would make it much easier for them to plan ahead and to manage how they're going to balance this kind of decarbonisation work with their routine repairs and maintenance, with their development programmes for those who do that. So that's one thing that would really help, just a bit more certainty about the operating environment that we're all in. And I think also just thinking about, is there more that government could do on things like, for example, the Net Zero Heat Fund, which we know has been helpful to members in doing that kind of decarbonising work, but could that provide more government funding to members? So could we get it up to 60%, for example, of government funding 60% of these bids rather than the 50% that's currently the limit? That would help if there was just a little bit more support available. All of that would help our members to do this really difficult juggling act that they're being asked to do. And, you know, it's important, it needs to happen, but trying to juggle the need to get existing stock up to standard and reduce their environmental impact while building homes and making sure that you look after your existing homes in terms of, you know, the quality, it's a big old ask.
Given that tenants will benefit dramatically with lower fuel bills as a result of getting fabric first or passive house standards if it's new build, if that's what's going to happen, you know, isn't it fair to actually claw some of that money back from the tenants to pay for the investment?
I think how we pay for this investment, and it's an enormous number, the figure that's going to be needed for investment, I think that is one of the key questions. And I think what we see is that tenants are already, a lot of tenants are already in a pretty difficult situation. We hear from members that increasingly they're having to provide help with things like food on the table and being able to put money on your meter. So I don't think it's a great time to be talking about, and we're also going to make tenants pay for retrofitting. I think that's quite a difficult conversation to have. And I think that there's an argument that we need to do this as a society. And given that social housing is already the most energy efficient housing in Scotland, how much can we expect what is often the poorest part of society to be paying for the kind of work that actually all of us need to be doing to our homes? So I think there's a real conversation to be had about how we're going to pay for this. But I think probably it's a pretty difficult argument to make that it should be tenants who pay for this.
One of the things we featured recently was Housing Association, one of your members, using carbon credits, getting financial institutions to buy heating systems effectively as a way of satisfying their obligations to reduce their carbon footprint. Is that something which is that in the early stages of development? I mean, what can you tell us about your members' involvement in that kind of thing?
I think it's a great example of the kind of creativity that our members show in trying to find ways to do the work that they need to do. It's not something I've heard a lot about. I don't think it's something that's particularly widespread, but I think it is a good example of we do need to think creatively, and that's what this sector is really good at, thinking creatively. I mean, we hear about other people getting involved in providing wind turbines for their area, using that to generate income. You know, there's all kinds of creative solutions, but we do need that kind of government leadership, I think, on something as massive as this. The sector can be really creative and is really creative, but I think we need that kind of certainty and clarity that really only government can provide by being clear about what are the standards that need to be met, what are the targets, and what is the best understanding that we have about the best technology to be using to do this kind of stuff.
That sounds like another plug for Berwickshire Housing Association there.
So, always happy to plug all of our members.
Over the previous winter, the SFHA was quite vital in helping to ensure that social landlords were able to respond to food and fuel insecurity. And you've asked, as part of your policy requirements for the programme for government, you've asked for this support to continue until at least the end of the parliamentary term. Now, as helpful as this would be, is it just a stopgap? I mean, is there a danger that if it is provided, it is seen by some as a solution and prevents any real change from being implemented?
I think that is a very sensible question. And there's always a balance, isn't there, between trying to help people in need right now and trying to take a much wider approach to actually what has led them to be in that situation. So what we've worked with government in a couple of ways through their winter hardship fund, which allowed us to distribute about £1 million to social landlords to help them help people get food on the table really throughout the winter, and we also worked with them on several different rounds of the Social Housing Fuel and Security Fund, which we've so far provided housing associations with over £7 million of funding to help I think about 55,000 households to actually pay for their fuel. So these are really helpful funds, and they are helping people to just keep the lights on and keep food on the table. And it feels shocking to me that in this time in this country that's what we're having to do, but that is the reality. And we hear that from our members. I was out at Clyde Valley Housing Association just this morning, and they were talking about they're seeing a level of need that they haven't seen before in just people needing that kind of help to keep themselves fed and clothed and with fuel. So there is an unarguable need right now, and that's why we think government ought to give the certainty of extending those funds as a permanent piece of provision until the end of this parliament. And we deliberately haven't asked for it to go further than that for the reasons that you say, because we understand that these things are a response to an immediate need. And actually what we need is something much further upstream to make sure that people don't find themselves in these situations. For example, along with the other federations of housing associations in elsewhere in the UK, we recently wrote to the Chancellor calling for a social tariff so that people don't have to pay, people on lower incomes don't have to pay very, very high fuel tariffs. We regularly work with the other federations on issues around social security, trying to make sure that people get the support they need through things like universal credit. So there absolutely are other things that we can do and should do. It's not just about providing funding. But at the same time, when people are in need right now, it seems to be the right thing to do to respond to that need right now.
I would imagine that most landlords would be extremely keen to see their tenants get out of poverty, because with the regulator's requirement that you have to deal with mould and damp and you know, work out exactly how much mould and damp you have in your stock, it's just a fact that if your tenants don't have enough money to turn the heating on, then they will have mould and damp in their homes. So how do you deal with that? And is there a way of helping tenants with dehumidifiers and paying their fuel bills, for example?
Yeah, so I mean, that was one of the things that the Fuel Insecurity Fund has done, is things like insulation measures, provide things like thick curtains, real basics, but things that do help to keep the heat in and keep homes warm. So that is one of the things that it has done. In terms of the wider issue of damp and mould, obviously there's a Scottish Parliament committee looking at this right now. I gave evidence to it earlier this year. And we know that our members are absolutely determined to make sure that they tackle the issue and that they're responding to it. We do know that the statistics suggest that most SOTO homes in Scotland are of a good quality and do not have serious issues with damp and mould. But that doesn't help you if you're one of the people that's living in a home that does have these issues. So it absolutely does need to be tackled. And you're right. If people can't afford to put their heating on, they're not going to open the windows to ventilate a property. And that's why it brings us back to, that's why it's so important to make sure that people are being supported so that they do get this kind of funding and they can keep their homes warm.
Another idea I've heard is for people drying clothes within their house, buying them heated drying rails. That would appear to be helpful in terms of reducing condensation. I mean, are there many practical ideas like that that you can encourage your members to share? Is there a forum where they can share good practice and share ideas?
Yeah, one of the things that SFHA does is provide guidance to our members, and we try and do that in partnership with others wherever we can. So earlier this year, we worked with the Chartered Institute of Housing Scotland and with Alacho to put together some guidance called Putting Safety First. And that was directly in response to the concerns that had been raised about damp and mould. And it was very much about just sharing some of the expert advice that we've heard about. And not so much the technical response, because we would never claim to be technical experts, but more about how to respond when tenants raise concerns, how to take proactive steps to make sure that the properties are being looked at to identify issues, and how to really work in partnership with tenants to make sure that, because they're the ones who live in the property, they know what the property's like. So making sure that they are heard and that they are given the best advice and support, and that, you know, where there's a property issue that needs tackled, that it is tackled. One of the things that the SFHA does is we run the Tech in Housing project with Scottish Government. And I know that my colleague Steph, who runs that, is a regular contributor to Scottish Housing News.
That's right.
So you'll be aware that one of the things the Tech programme does is it tries to find ways of using technology to address things like this. So, for example, monitors that can monitor the level of condensation in a home, and just things that can make it easier to intervene earlier and identify a problem at an early stage. So we're always looking for ways that we can either share helpful guidance or bring our members together so they can tell each other about what they're doing. You know, forums and events and conferences are a big part of the programme of work that we run. And sometimes that's about us bringing in external speakers to share knowledge. But just as often, it's about us just spotlighting what our members are doing, because it's such a diverse sector and there's so much great work that quite often the best thing we can do is shine a light on something a member is doing already.
So you've submitted the briefing to ministers for the programme for government. You have said to yourself you've turned up to committee hearings. How effective is this lobbying? Is the government receptive to yourself, your members, and to the social housing sector?
I mean, you'd have to ask the government, but I would think I would say broadly yes. I mean, we have a track record of being able to demonstrate impact on things that matter to our members. I mentioned already the EF2 review, which we successfully argued to be brought forward after our chief exec, Sally Thomas, had co-chaired the ZEST review. We saw last year, I mentioned the impact of the Cost of Living Act on mid-market rent properties. When that first came in, that introduced the idea of rent controls on social housing. And through partnership working with our members, we were able to demonstrate that actually that was going to be really counterproductive and put that target of 110,000 new affordable homes by 2032 really in jeopardy. So I think we've got a good track record of being able to demonstrate that when we put forward an argument, we can have an impact. And that's really our job. That's what we're here for, is to put forward sensible constructive arguments. We always try and conduct ourselves in a way that is constructive and that puts forward arguments that we've really thought through and we've checked out with our members. And after that, it's up to government what they want to do. But I think there is a track record to suggest that they will listen and we will have some impact.
And what's next for the campaign then? How can others take part?
So we're really keen particularly for our members to get involved and to share their examples of the amazing work that they've been doing. When we launched the campaign at our annual conference in June, we shared a short film of tenants from three of our members talking about the different ways that they had been helped and supported. And we'd love more of that. And we're always keen on hearing about the kind of end impact, if you like, of the work that our members do. So hearing about how people have benefited is always great. For example, when we put out our programme for government calls today, we shared the story of Betty, who's a tenant at Horizon Housing Association, who was able to access a social home that met her health needs. So she had various needs about an accessible house. She needed help with social security, she needed help with employability, and she was given an adapted home that was wheelchair accessible. And she talks about the impact that's had and how much that has changed their life. And that's the kind of story that we love to hear. So on the SFHA website, members can get in touch with us, they can share their experiences, and also they can always tell us what else we should be doing, because there's always more we can do. We constantly learn from members about their experiences on the ground and what more we can be doing to support them, provide them with information, influence government. So we always want to hear that as well.
Excellent. Thanks again for coming on and sharing the campaign with us, Carolyn. Thanks to Jimmy Black, my co-host. I'm Kieran Finlay, and we'll be back with another episode in a couple of weeks.